We're doing Parashat Shavua this week. It's Nitzavim and Vayelech together. So we combine them because we have one more Shabbat before Simchat Torah, technically. What's going to happen now is this week we read Nitzavim and Vayelech together. Next Shabbat, it's going to be 2 days Rosh Hashanah and then Shabbat. And that's the last Shabbat of the year, really. That's the last Shabbat of the reading. We'll read Ha'azinu, the Song of Ha'azinu. The following Shabbat is Yom Kippur. The following Shabbat is already Shabbat Chol HaMoed of Sukkot. And then you run into Simchat Torah. So it's we combine Nitzavim and Vayelech together because we lose a Shabbos on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur falls out on Shabbos. And then we don't have a regular Shabbos reading on Shabbat Chol HaMoed. So technically we have two more Shabbatot with regular reading until Simchat Torah. So that's why this week we combine Nitzavim and Vayelech. Okay, so Vayelech will take us to the last day of Moshe Rabbeinu's life. Vayelech is the parasha that focuses on that last day. From there to the end of Torah was all one day. But Nitzavim was still Moshe's speech after last week's parasha. Last week's parasha, he told the Jewish people, what a stern warning, what can happen if they don't adhere to the Torah. This week's parasha, he gives them a pep talk. So this pep talk, where Moshe tells them, you made it this far, you're going to make it, don't worry, even though there are all these stern warnings, you can do it. We tend to forget this. This idea of giving a pep talk, telling people how much they can do it, how much they've done. One area you'll come across it in your lives, Be'ezrat Hashem, is when your wife is giving birth, and you'll be there next to her, and you can tell her she's doing great, and she needs to hear that. In life, when we tell someone they're doing great, it gives them strength. We have to be able to tell someone, you're doing great. Kol hakavod. I've seen many times that students can give up when they're doing really well. And if only someone would tell them, you're doing great, that would give them the energy to keep going. People don't see themselves. People don't realize their successes. People need to hear that, the positive feedback from someone else. So Moshe Rabbeinu gives us that. He says, I know I told you all these warnings, but you guys are doing great. Look at you. You're standing proud. You're standing tall. All the people that are here made it. Atem nitzavim hayom kulchem. You're all standing. You made it. The pasuk says in Mishle that when we rebuke a child, so it says, ki et asher yehav Hashem yochiach, et asher yehav Hashem, the one who Hashem loves, yochiach, Hashem rebukes, uch'av et ben yirtzeh. And just like a father appeases his child, explains Rashi, a good father, after he rebukes his son, he hugs him, he kisses him, he takes him for a good time. When we rebuke, there has to be a counterbalance. Even if you say, but my kid deserves the rebuke, they also need positive. They need to be reminded that you love them. They need to be reminded that things are going good. And very often we remember the part to rebuke them, and we forget the part to strengthen them. Moshe Rabbeinu finished his long rebuke, his long warning of where things can go, and he right away gives us strength. He right away tells us how great we are. Atem nitzavim hayom kulchem. You're all here united. And Moshe Rabbeinu tells them, we know the famous allegory about a father who's lying on his deathbed, and he calls in his children, and he gives them each a twig, and each one he says, can you break it? They each break it in a second. Then he takes a pack of twigs, and he gives them to each kid, can you break it? And no one can break it. And he tells them, right, when you're united, no one can break you. When you're divided, anyone can break you. You have to know it's your unity that gives you strength. And that's the message Moshe Rabbeinu tells them. Atem nitzavim hayom, you're standing here today, kulchem, because you're all united. And then Moshe Rabbeinu goes on and he lists the hierarchy of the Jewish people. Rashechem, your head, Ziknechem, your elders, your children, your wives, your water drawers. He goes from the top of the hierarchy to the bottom. And the Medrash says, Moshe was telling them, but in front of Hashem, He loves all of you. There's an equality here. We sometimes think maybe He's closer to Hashem, but Hashem's close to all of us. On the contrary, Hashem says, Ve'etdaka, I am with the person who is lowly. This is the recurring theme of Psalms, that Hashem is with the underdog. A person shouldn't think that because he's struggling or he's struggling to keep mitzvot, so Hashem doesn't care for his prayer. No. You guys know the famous story of the shepherd, right? The Hasidic story. Right, the shepherd came to shul, everyone's crying, everyone's davening, he doesn't know how to daven. So in the middle of davening, they see the Rebbe's shaking fervently and he doesn't stop, and they see that the Rebbe's really worried over something, and then the shepherd sees the fervor, the whole shul is getting into things and they're all uptight. They see how uptight the Rebbe is, everyone's praying, he gets uptight and he doesn't know what to say, so he's standing there shaking and everyone's shaking and he's shaking, and they're all davening and yelling, and then finally he has to do something, so he pulls out his whistle, his shepherd's whistle, and he blows it in the middle of the shul. So he makes his expression. So all the Hasidim stop their davening and they turn around. Now he did it with all the kavanah, right? He was fully focused. He meant to say his tefillah with that. And the Rebbe stops his davening and he says, okay, now there was a decree in heaven, that's what broke the decree in heaven, that whistle. The expression, the pure expression, so it doesn't have to be from the top, it has to be from a pure soul. And that's what Hashem says, I'm listing all of you, I'm close to all of you. The Pasuk lists those who would cut wood and draw water. Who are they? So our sages say that people emigrated from Canaan into the desert and came to Moshe and tried to trick him and say, we want to become a part of the Jewish people, we came from a faraway land. And Moshe said, you can join, you'll be water drawers, you'll cut wood. And they were given this task, which was considered the most menial task, but they were allowed, even though Canaanites generally are not allowed to join, the whole people of Canaan are given a choice. Do you want to make peace? Do you not want to make peace? These people who came of their own were allowed to take these jobs and stay in our midst. So Hashem is making a covenant with us. What's this great covenant? So in last week's parasha, we had the covenant that we're taking responsibility to do all the mitzvot, and if not, there's a stern warning. Now Hashem says, we're going to make this covenant to establish the idea that you're my nation, and I'm your God, and we're faithful to one another, and all future generations are taking this responsibility. And part of the responsibility, Hashem says, is maybe in all this history you saw an idol and you thought to yourself, that's really cool, I really want to do that. And maybe somewhere deep down in your heart you're telling yourself, everyone else will have it good, the Jewish people will have all their blessings, and I'll be one of them. I'll do what I want at home. I'll go to shul, I'll be a good Jew, and all the blessings the Jewish people will get, I'll get together with them. And then on my own, I'll do what I want. I'll have a little idol in my closet. Whenever I feel uptight, whenever I feel I need a different type of blessing, I'll go and do my idol worship. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, that's not going to work. First of all, there's mutual responsibility. Once we enter the land of Israel, if I know my neighbor's doing something wrong, I'm responsible. You don't live alone. Moshe Rabbeinu says, you've been in the desert, you're 2 million individuals. You're entering the land of Israel, you're becoming a people. There's responsibility for one another. In the desert, you didn't yet have that. Now you have that. You're going to walk into Eretz Israel, you cannot turn a blind eye. If you know that something like that is going on, you have a responsibility to deal. You can't just say, not my business, what he does in his house. If you know that's what he's doing, you have to deal. Secondly, Hashem says, I'll deal with the individual. Now, it's interesting the way the Torah describes it. The Torah describes a person who has a root which will grow to be a bitter plant. Shoresh, a root, poreh, that will give fruits, to Rosh v'lana. Rosh and lana are two types of bitter or poisonous plants. So that's how Hashem describes a person who has these thoughts within him. And perhaps over here the Torah is telling us something about what type of people we have to be. A person sometimes allows himself to fantasize about evil things. Hashem created within each person a dark side. We all have the capacity to be sadistic. We all have the capacity to be not only cruel, but demented. There are parts of us, there are dark sides to our personality, which can really be bad. Now the question is, what does a person do with that? So a person can say, okay, I don't know why this is a part of me, but I'm not going to let that flourish. I'm not going to pursue that. I'm going to think positive thoughts. I'm going to try to think of positive things. The way people end up doing terrible things is because they allow their terrible thoughts to flourish. When a person says, no, I don't want to be that type of person. That's not who I am. That's not my identity. It's not what I believe in. Hashem created me with certain desires. There are certain weaknesses I have within me. There's a dark side to me. That's not the side I'm going to develop. So if my thoughts start wandering in that direction, I'm not going to think about it. Well, how does a person end up doing all kinds of violent, cruel crimes? Well, it doesn't usually happen that moment that he saw something, he got excited, he decided he's going to do it. It's usually that when he allowed himself to fantasize in a certain direction and to think about a certain direction, so then eventually, when the opportunity showed itself, he actually acted that way. But if we train our thoughts to be in positive directions and not let our thoughts wander into those dark areas, so then we're not letting that root flourish. And on the contrary, how do you uproot that? When you decide that's not who I am. I'm not going to behave that way. I'm not going to think that way. I'm not going to fantasize about that. My thoughts will not go there. And the Torah warns us. You have a guy who's thinking. It's interesting. There are idols. There are all kinds of things out there. I'm going to wait till we land in Israel. And then we'll see. That we'll see is dangerous. That the Torah is saying, Shoresh, there's a root there that will ultimately flourish. One of the things we have to know about us human beings is that what we think about and fantasize about, eventually we find ways of realizing. If not in this way, then in another way. And that's what Chazal say, that when a person looks at and desires things that they shouldn't, they ultimately find themselves doing things they really wish they wouldn't have done. So the root here is taking control of our thoughts, ensuring that our thoughts are what they should be. And again, I think it's very empowering when we realize, yes, it's a part of every human being, and no, I'm not going to let my thoughts wander there. I'm going to be focused on the positive, and I'm going to insist for myself that I will be a positive person. They want to figure out how people make decisions. How do we decide whether we're going to give a charity or not? How do we decide whether we're going to join a rally or not? How do we decide whether we're going to partake of an event or not? How do we decide where we invest our money, where we invest our time? And they came to a conclusion that people define themselves a certain way. Meaning a person can say, I'm an Orthodox Jew. A person can say, I'm an observant Orthodox Jew. A person can say, I'm a kind member of my kehillah. But subconsciously, we give ourselves certain titles. And then when we face decisions, we turn back to those titles and we ask ourselves, does a person who is X, Y, Z, whatever it is, do they behave this way? I have a friend who's a very serious chozer b'tshuva. He told me he learned here. I don't remember when he learned here. I met him again years after he learned here. And it's always interesting for me to see him in the winter wearing a fleece that says on it, Harvard. Because he's a guy who wakes up at 4 o'clock in the morning to learn and daven v'sikin, and he volunteers in all kinds of organizations. And if you'd ask me, this guy who has a beard down to here and payas out to here, and I would identify him not as Harvard, but rather as a tzaddik, chozer b'tshuva, a person who does kindness to the Jewish people. I have a lot of wonderful things to say about him. He does a lot of wonderful things. But it's always interesting for me when I see him in the winter wearing his sweatshirt that says Harvard. Is that the identifying marker when he asks himself, should I donate to shul? Should I wake up v'sikin? Is it Harvard that answers the question? A Harvard boy doesn't get up after 4 o'clock in the morning. I don't think that's the answer. So, okay, he's interested in wearing that sweatshirt. But I think that when you'd ask him, who are you? I don't think that's the number one title. People get hung up on that title. But is that really your identifying marker? I don't think so. Again, we decide. Every person decides for themselves. Part of what we have to do, part of our tshuva now in the month of Elul and Tishrei, is also to define ourselves. I am. What am I? I am a. How do I continue that sentence? I remember I was in second or third grade, and the Rebbe went all around the classroom and asked every child, what are you going to be when you grow up? So one child said a fireman, another child said a policeman, another child said he's going to be a doctor, a third child said a lawyer. And the Rebbe goes all around the classroom, and then he goes, boys, that's interesting because stuck with me till today. He said, you're going to be a Talmud Chacham, you're going to be a Reish Amayim, you're going to be a Tzaddik. How you make money is a different question. It's not what you're going to be. You are not a banker, you are not a lawyer, you are a Jew who does mitzvot. And he would do this a few times during the year. He'd say, you shouldn't say, I'm going to be a fireman. You're going to be a person who does kind things for people. That's what you're going to be. How you make money is a separate question. It's not what you're going to be. Well, how we define what we are, that defines a lot of our decisions. The Ribbono Shel Olam says, if you start thinking, you know, when we get into Israel, maybe I'll find a way to catch up with that idol that I missed back from Egypt. There are things that were fun back there. Not, that ultimately becomes that bitter root that bears fruit. Thoughts bear fruit. We have to try to think positive. Ribbono Shel Olam also warns that even when everyone else is blessed, it does not mean that Hashem won't single a person out and punish him directly. A person shouldn't think because there's mutual responsibility and the warning was for all the people that he's going to get away with it. Hashem says no. The Aliyah ends with Hanistarot Lashem Elokeinu. Hashem says, whatever you can't see is my responsibility. I got to deal with it. Vaniglot, but whatever you do know, Lanu Vanenu Adolam, we have mutual responsibility. Now that mutual responsibility is a wonderful thing, because it means that when I do a mitzvah, you're going to hear a shofar Rosh Hashanah morning. You did your mitzvah, right? You finished it. You heard everything you had to hear. The answer is wrong. You didn't finish the mitzvah. Did your neighbor hear shofar? Did the other neighbor hear shofar? Until everyone hears shofar, you didn't do your mitzvah. You did part of your mitzvah. But our mutual responsibility makes it that I have to take care of my neighbor. So if my neighbor, I have an old neighbor who doesn't know how to make Kiddush Friday night, I can make Kiddush for my family and go knock on her door and say, can I make Kiddush for you too? How could you make Kiddush for her? You made Kiddush for your family. That's the concept of Arevut. We have mutual responsibility. It's not only a negative, it's a major positive. That's why when I'd be in the hospital, I'd go around and make Kiddush in different wards, because there were a lot of people who didn't know how to make Kiddush. So you can make Kiddush for them. It's you're performing mitzvah for them, because that's part of your responsibility. That's part of what the Torah is saying when it says we're responsible for one another. It also means that when we do positive things, we affect the world. I'm not just affecting me. That's the idea, the famous idea that when a Jew speaks Lashon Hara in Berlin, a Jew in the United States might desecrate Shabbos because of the Jew who spoke Lashon Hara in Berlin. Because we're connected. Hashem says, from this point onward, you're connected. And what you do has a ripple effect. We affect one another. Don't think that your actions are alone. You affect everyone. We're responsible to help one another. We're responsible to help do mitzvot for one another. And we should know that our actions affect the world. We're not living alone. There's a ripple effect. Okay, we're up to Sheni now that the Parashiot are together. Torah says, very interesting mitzvah. Imagine the following scenario. You have two kids. You have a 7-year-old son and a 5-year-old daughter. You're sitting at the Shabbos table, and you see your 7-year-old son pulling your 5-year-old daughter's pigtails. So she's sitting to eat, and suddenly, ow! So you look at him, you go, Shmuley, please stop pulling your sister's pigtails. He thinks you're not looking. 2 minutes later, bam, he pulls her pigtails. You saw it. Shmuley, we said you're going to stop, right? Of course, Dad, I'm going to, of course. What happens 2 minutes later? You know what happens 2 minutes later. So at some point you tell him, look, you're going to do that again. You're going to have to go to your room. You're not going to sit here and torture your sister. And what happens 2 minutes later? He does it again. So now, this is the fourth or fifth time, you say, that's it. Shmuel, you got to go to your room. So what does he do? So imagine that he goes, I'm so sorry. Can I apologize to her, please? What do you say as a parent? too late, buddy. Now you're going to pay the bill. The time to apologize was the first time, and the second time, and the fourth time, now the fifth time. No. Leave. Goodbye. But I really want to apologize. You can apologize. Go to your room. Apologize and then go to your room. You should apologize, right? But Dad, I really feel bad. I realize it was wrong. Okay. So apologize and then go to your room. But Dad, I'm really sorry. Right? You're sorry. You should be sorry. Good. So apologize sincerely and then go to your room. What would happen if it were something more serious? What would happen if it's the guy who's responsible for overseeing tests at medical school? And the reputation is that you can bribe him and he'll pass you. He'll let you stick in your notes. So he gets caught once and they give him a warning. He gets caught twice. What happens on the third time when he says, I'm really sorry. I understand what I did was criminal. Can you imagine that they won't remove him from the job forever? What happens about the guy who was caught drinking and driving and he endangered other people's lives? What happens that second or third time? Would you ever give him his license again? What happens on the fifth time? What happens on the seventh time? What happens when he's in jail and he comes back and he says, I'm really sorry? And the judge says, yeah, you're sorry. You're going to pay for it. And the guy says, I've been in jail for a week now. I have a sentence of 2 years. Let me out. I'm really sorry. Yeah, who would listen to him? Says the Torah, Hashem will listen. Torah tells us an amazing gift. When things happen bad, when you know that you're being punished for what you did wrong, and you do tshuva, real tshuva, so Hashem says, I'll bring you back. What do you mean I'll bring you back? That means the Ribbono Shel Olam says, I have no interest in punishing you. My interest is it should be good. You sometimes aren't willing to listen without a punishment. It's an interesting thing as a parent. We over-assume what our children understand. I once asked one of the kids, why do you think Abba and Ima ever yell at you or punish you? So the kid looks at me and says, do you enjoy it? I was shocked. No, because the kid was serious. The kid wasn't saying it to be chutzpahdeg. The kid was like really asking me a question. So I asked, what do you think? And the kid says, I don't know. So I realized I'm missing a major component of my chinuch. Meaning if this child can ask me, do you enjoy it? If this child can ask me, why are you doing this to me? So then in his mind, I'm not getting the message across. That means I have to explain. I have to spell it out to the child because of A, B, C, and D. And I've tried explaining it to you numerous times and you're not listening. So you're going to have to pay a certain price so that you get it through your head that you can't do that. So we have a balcony in our house that's about 30 feet high. It's very, very high. So we have, when you walk out to the porch, you have basically two stories under you. And there's a wall, so no one can go off it. So imagine a child starts climbing that wall. They put one chair, they put another chair, and they're climbing the wall. So now they've just endangered themselves, right? If you're going to react harshly, and you don't explain to the child the danger, they don't understand. We as adults, very often, we miss the point that the kid, if you didn't explain it to him, he doesn't know what you want from him. The punishment is not obvious to the child. Why are you reacting so harshly? Why do you tell me I can't play on the porch anymore for the rest of Shabbos? Why? I don't know why. So to us, it's obvious. To a child, it's not obvious. The Torah says, when Hashem does something, it's only to get the message across. We're the same way as parents. What's the reason we don't forgive? What's the reason we're not willing to let go? Because we're not sure the message got across. What do you mean you're really sorry? If you knew for a fact that your child is really sorry, they really don't mean to do it again, you have no interest in the child suffering. All you have is love for the child. You don't want the child to feel bad. Ah, that's what Hashem says. A tremendous gift. Hashem says, I'm the merciful judge. If after things go wrong, you do tshuva, I don't say, oh, you only did tshuva because you're suffering. I say, if it's real, fine. So it's legitimate for a person to do tshuva because things are bad in their life. It's not only legitimate, it's right. Sometimes the Ribbono Shel Olam says, what do you want me to do? I'm sending you wake-up calls. What's the reason things are going wrong in your life? So you should wake up. No, so wake up. Meaning a person will sometimes say, I'm only going to shul because things are bad in my life. Right? Maybe that's why they're bad in your life, because Hashem wants you to go to shul. So the Rabban Shalom says in our parsha, if things go bad and then you do tshuva, so Hashem says, I'm bringing you back. And here the Torah promises us, as far as a Jew will be exiled, Hashem will bring him back. And this idea was expanded upon in the Hasidut, that it's not only talking about physical distance, it's also spiritual distance. When the Torah says, if you have someone who's so far away, they're so far removed that they've reached the edges of heaven. Sometimes people spiritually go on journeys that they reach the edges of heaven. It's as though you can't go any further than this from Judaism. Hashem says, I want you back even from there. That's a promise of the Torah. Hashem wants us back. And Hashem says, I'll bring you back to the land of Israel and things will be good for you. The Torah gives us a fantastic promise. You and your children will do tshuva. So this is a wake-up call to us. Very often when a person does tshuva, there's a backlash. Their children react the other way. A person says, I'm leaving all the nonsense that my parents did, that I grew up with. I'm going to lead an adherent lifestyle. And suddenly they see their children go in the exact opposite direction. It's a special promise. Hashem says that there'll come a time where He'll help us, that our children won't have that backlash. Part of the key to trying and helping our children grow up as balanced adults who adhere to Torah is, number one, don't be too strict. Number two, don't be too strict. And number three, don't be too strict. There's a tendency when a person does tshuva that they demand of their kids on a level that the kids can't handle. And their insistence, because people are very real. When a person does tshuva, they're very real. They've left everything for this. So now if the child starts being a child and doing foolish things as a child, the parent doesn't have the patience for it. What are you doing? Excuse me. The answer is, I'm being a child. But this is stupid. The answer is, I'm a child. I'm supposed to be stupid. That's my job. I'm a child. Yes, you were a child. You were stupid. I'm a child. I'm stupid. Let the child be stupid. A child is supposed to have periods in their life where they do stupidities. So parents sometimes get very excited that their child wants to learn Torah all day. Maybe he shouldn't. Maybe your job as a parent is to say, go out and play. You can't learn Torah all day. Very often, because a person does tshuva, so they're so into it and they're so excited that they're willing to go extreme, and then they want their children to go extreme, and then the children end up being burnt. So the first three rules are, don't be too strict. You have to let the kids live. The fourth rule is, don't fluctuate too much. You want to continue growing, that's very nice. There has to be consistency in the home. The fifth rule is, a home has to be pleasant. You have to want to come home. It has to be fun. If religion takes on this tense atmosphere in the house, Shabbos is coming, Zmiros, everyone has to sing, Yom Kippur's coming. Kids need to have fun. And the sixth rule is, you have to have shalom bayis. There has to be peace in the house. Tov, there are more, but for now we'll stick with these. Hashem says, I'll help you have the future generations continue on your path, which is a special gift. It's not obvious. Hashem says, there'll be blessings and the curses will go on the enemies. And then Hashem says, this is contingent on a complete tshuva on your behalf. So the commentaries explain, when we start off tshuva, sometimes we start off because there's external stimuli. A person had a hardship in their life. A person wants Hashem to help them in certain things in their life. And all of this is not the pure tshuva. Hashem says, I expect you ultimately to do a complete tshuva. To do a tshuva that you're connected to Hashem with your heart and soul. And here we're up to Shishi and Nitzavim. Hashem says, the beautiful promise, Hashem says, the mitzvos I'm commanding you are not covered from you. They are not distant from you. you can do it. The Torah is saying the Torah is accessible. It's an amazing gift the Torah is telling us. This isn't some kind of legal code that you have to go to university for 50 years and you never know if you understand it. Hashem says the Torah is accessible. You don't have to climb up to the heavens. You don't have to go into the Himalayas. You don't have to cross the seas. You don't have to cross seven islands. A person might say, how could I ever learn Torah? Hashem says it's right near you. Ki karov elecha davar meod. And here we have the concept that Torah is accessible. Every Jew has to know he can access Torah. And today it's more accessible than ever. Look at our website. Look at Mechon Meir. Torah is accessible. You have Art Scroll. You have so many ways to learn Torah. But the Torah is telling us a concept that the Torah in principle is accessible. The Medrash says, Eliyahu Anavi says the following story. Pamachat hayiti me'alech baderech. I was once walking down the path, says Elio, umtzani adam echad, a man found me. Vayam mitlotzetz umalig bidvarai. And he was joking, making fun of what I was saying. Amarti lo matashiv li yotzecha li yom adin. When I saw he was making fun of my teachings, says Elio, I said to him, what are you going to answer when judgment day comes and Hashem asks you, why didn't you learn Torah? You're making fun of the Torah I'm teaching. Well, one day God's going to ask you, why didn't you learn Torah? What are you going to say? Amali, so the man says to me, I have an excuse. I have it all worked out. I'm not worried. When God asks me why I didn't learn Torah, I'm going to answer, God, you didn't give me knowledge. You didn't give me understanding. I don't know how to read Tanakh. I don't know how to read Mishnah. I can't learn Torah. God created me a dunce. I said to him, says Elio, son, what do you do for a living? He said to me, I'm a hunter. I asked him, what do you mean you're a hunter? If you're a hunter, that means you know how to pick flax, and then you know how to spin the flax into strings, and then you know how to spin the strings into thicker strings, and then you know how to weave those strings into nets, and then you know how to throw those nets into the sea and figure out exactly where the waves are headed and how to hunt your fish. So how do you know how to do all that? So the man says, well, God gave me a lot of understanding. You know, I'm a smart guy. I know how to do that. So I said to him, says Elio, so God gave you the understanding to plant and grow and pick flax. God gave you the understanding to weave the nets. God gave you the understanding to know where and how to throw those nets into the sea and take out the fish. That, they gave you the tools. But to learn Torah, you think they didn't give you the tools. But the Torah says it's right near you. Torah is accessible to you. It's not true. God's given you a lot of capacity of knowledge and understanding. You could learn Torah. And your excuse, Elio is alluding, will not hold any water when you get to heaven. Says Elio Anavi, when I said it to him, the man started crying bitterly. He suddenly realized he was tricking himself his whole life. He kept thinking, I can't do it, I can't do it. And so he gave himself that excuse, and his whole life he lived with that excuse. It's too hard, I can't do it. And then he started crying and crying until I calmed him down, says Elio. And I said to him, don't feel so bad. Everyone on the planet gives this excuse, but everyone on the planet is a hypocrite. Their own actions prove that they could do it. And that's why they'll ultimately be embarrassed by their own actions. That's the Medrash. Now, the Medrash is telling us a phenomenal concept in education. We very often don't succeed because we don't believe we can do it. The first message we need to get through our heads is, I can do it. If we believe we can, we've accomplished 50% of getting the job done. How many of you have thought that you can learn all of Shas? How many of you have thought that you can master Tanakh? How many of you have thought for a minute that you can really know how to learn Tanakh, Mishnah, Talmud, and ultimately teach it? Stop and realize you can. You can do it. Rav Sperling came in to hear a student. Rav Hyman came in to hear a student. Rav Listman came in to hear a student. Rav Begun started learning as a student. Rav Begun didn't know Kriyat Shema. When Rav Bigun sent his first letter to Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, he sent it to him saying, I don't understand the Shema. He came to Merkaz Harav and said, I'm starting to read Shema, I'm a tour guide, I sort of have to know what the Shema says. And he came and he had questions on how to understand the Shema. That's how he started in Merkaz Harav. He walked in and said, I have questions on what the Shema is. Half the staff here, if not more, started out not knowing what Judaism was. And they grew and they grew and they grew because they decided, I can do it. The first step in growth is the decision, I can. After that, you can grow. So it sounds like something I should know, right? I'm preaching it, I should know it. Let me tell you, approximately 20 years ago, I was in Rav Feinstein's yeshiva and I went and consulted with one of the rabbis there how I should set up my learning. And the rabbi said to me, you're young, make sure to cover ground now, because your memory when you're 19 is not the same as your memory when you're 23, and your memory when you're 23 is not the same as your memory when you're 28, and by the time you're 32, it's a different world altogether. I listened to him, I tried to cover ground, I learned, I reviewed, okay. And then the dark day came when I had a 32nd birthday, and suddenly I'm 32. And these words haunted me that when you're 28, it's not the same as 25. And when you're 32, it's not the same as 28. And from the time I was about 32 onward, in my mind, I was already an old man as far as my learning. I continued learning, but I kept feeling like it's just not sticking. It's just not, I'm not retaining it the way I used to. Okay, a few years passed and I had the good fortune of walking Rabbi Nachum Rom. When he was going to teach, we taught in the same yeshiva. And now Rabbi Nachum Rom, he should live and be well, is a man who you could ask him where a word shows up in Shas, and he'll tell you where it is in Shas. He's got a phenomenal memory. So as I was walking with him to the bus stop, I said to him, can you give me a tip on how to remember what you learn? So he said one thing, he said another thing. And then I said, you probably got most of your learning done when you were a youngster. You remember things so well. He says, what do you mean? I said, well, my rabbis taught me, as you age, your memory goes. So I'm talking to a man who's already in his 60s, so I figure how much memory can he have left? So he looks at me and he says, I don't know. I find I'm remembering things much better now than when I was younger. I'm not sure that your memory goes as you age. I'm not sure that's so. I said, what? He said, yeah, when I learn, I'm going home. I'm going to be learning the rest of the afternoon. I don't find that I can't remember things just because I'm older. No, I don't think that's so. Eye-opener. My world changed after 4 years thinking I was finished, doomed, half-dead, brain-dead, right? Learning and consigning myself to this idea, okay, I'm just not meant to remember. I suddenly opened the Gemara with a new approach. So your memory doesn't disappear at 32. Sounds stupid. I had the good fortune of having a student here named Danny Palcik. Danny Palcik learned here many years ago, and he had a book, The Jewish Mind. Someone did research on how Jews learn Talmud. And he wrote a book, which was translated into many languages. So he read the book. And then he said to me, you should know that the greatest factor in what you can and cannot remember is your decision whether you can and cannot remember. He said, every person decides I don't have a good memory for A or B or C, for names, for numbers, for many things. And once you get over that and decide you can remember, then you can really remember. So I wasn't a skeptic, I just thought it was nonsense. Skeptic is a light word for what I thought about that idea. But I had to respect it. First of all, I try to respect anything you guys say. And secondly, I mean, he's bringing real research. And then I decided to try and apply it. And I found amazing things happened. My whole life, I couldn't remember three numbers straight. I couldn't remember three numbers. You'd tell me three numbers, I'd say, let me write it down. Suddenly, I could remember telephone numbers by heart. Suddenly, I could remember long lists of numbers by heart. Where'd that come from? Because I was open to remembering it. I had shut down my mind. I decided I can't remember it. I met someone two nights ago, and he says to me, you know, there are so many students over the last decade who we haven't seen in the Machon. And he starts describing them, and one after another, I tell him the names. He goes, how do you remember their names? I'm very bad with names, right? Now, if you decide you're bad, you're bad. If you If you decide you can do it. So I'm standing there, and every guy he's telling me, I'm telling him the name. And this is going on for like 2 minutes. We're going guy after guy. He asked me, where's this guy going? He said, no, he changed his name. That's not his name anymore. Here's where I have his contact info. I shocked myself, because I really think I have a bad memory for names. But I decided I'm not going to think that. I can do it. Comes the Torah and tells us about Torah. Karov elecha davar meod. Torah is so close to you. Beficha vilvavcha la'asato. You can do it. You can do it with your mouth. You can do it with your heart. The Torah is telling us the first principle in learning Torah. The first principle, you have to realize you can. You can succeed. When you realize you can, that's when you can start succeeding. It's a rule in tshuva, it's a rule in learning. And so the Torah reiterates it. It's close to you. It's near your mouth. It's near your heart. From here we also learn the idea that Torah, there is this oral Torah, beficha. There's a Torah that's only going to be in your mouth. It shouldn't be written down. And that's the halacha that we say, dvarim shebichtav, the Torah that's supposed to be written, you're not allowed to say it by heart. If you want to read in the Torah, even though you know your bar mitzvah parsha by heart, you're not allowed to read it by heart. You have to read it from the Torah scroll, right? Dvarim shebichtav, things from the written text, when you read them for the masses, you're not allowed to do it by heart. You read Megillah Esther, you have to read it from the Megillah, from the text. Dvarim shebe'al peh, the oral Torah, i'ata rashai lekotvam, you're not allowed to write them down. So you're not allowed to write down a Mishnah, you're not allowed to write down a Gemara. The oral law has to remain oral. The rabbis realized that under the Roman persecution and the exile, the scattering of the Jews, the persecution that wouldn't allow us to convene in yeshivas, they had no choice. So they wrote down the Mishnah and the Talmud. But really the Torah says, Beficha vilvavcha la'asoto. The way to perform Torah is by heart. You have to know the oral Torah by heart. And it's doable. In order for someone to get a title Gaon, they had to be tested on all of the Shas, all those volumes, by heart. They had to be able to go through the whole Shas by heart. That's how you got the title Gaon. And that's post-Talmud. Okay? That's, yes, sir?
If you know the Amidah by heart, can you say it without reading?
Yes. We said Dvarim Shebichtav, the written Torah. Yeah. And we said when you're reading it to the masses, to be motzi other people. Torah then gives us another beautiful, powerful concept. The Torah says, I've given you before you life and that which is good, and death and that which is evil. Choose life. So the Torah is telling us we have free will. Now, everyone knows that we have predispositions. You see, as children are born, there's nurture and nature, but within their nature, we have different predispositions. People are born and they have different tendencies, and it's not their fault. Very often people have tendencies, that's the way Hashem created them, they have desires, it's not their fault. But it's their responsibility to channel it. It's a person's responsibility to make the right choices. The Talmud says there are people who are born and they have a lust for blood. They should be butchers. There are people who have to see blood in their day. Hashem created that nature within man. David HaMelech had this tendency that he was ready to be a murderer. He channeled it to kill those that were right according to the law of Torah. He would not touch a fly. He was the most gentle person, but he had it within him. That's why when Shmuel sees him, he says, I see Esav walking into the room. He turns to God and says, I'm supposed to anoint him, sorry, not you, him as the king. That's a man who I see is going to kill a lot of people. The Rebbe Hashem says, yeah, he's going to kill the right people. He's going to do it right. He's going to do it for the right reasons and the right people. Hashem creates people with different predispositions. There's no denying that. I don't have the weaknesses other people have. Other people don't have the weaknesses I have. We all have challenges we have to contend with. The Torah says channel them. You have a guy who likes to be a nudnik. He likes to be, you know, people like that. You know, they're always nudniking people. So they should be fundraisers. They could be shadchanim. There are things which they can do, which you're supposed to be a nudnik in order to succeed at that. We have to channel it. You have a guy who always wants to talk. So make him a gabbai. He'll always be making announcements. It's good for him. The fact that you have a predisposition doesn't have to be bad. You have to channel it for positive. Predispositions exist. They have to be channeled. Sometimes they have to be conquered. It's rare, but sometimes they have to be conquered. There isn't always a way to channel it. But Hashem tells us you have a choice. The Torah says, "Uvachalta b'chayim," choose life. My father always told us that the human being has the nature of the moth. On some level, the moth is attracted to fire that kills it, right? The human being also has a certain attraction to things that can kill him. People don't always run after drugs only because of the drugs. It's dangerous. There's something that attracts us. Why do people drag race? There are things that people do because there's the thrill of the danger. Comes the Torah and says, choose life. Don't play with your life. Don't do dangerous things. We're lazy sometimes to protect ourselves. Is it such a big deal to put on a seatbelt? When I go to your guys' weddings, you should know, I don't just go on rides. I ask people, did you drink? So people sometimes get upset at me. My life is important to me. The Torah says, "Uvachata b'chayim," choose life. Make sure you're not playing games with it. If something could be dangerous, don't do it. There's a human tendency to play with life, to do things that just might be dangerous. There's a thrill. Don't. And realize it when it happens. I've seen people go into all kinds of dangerous situations just for that thrill. And it's not legitimate. It exists, and it's wrong. The Rambam says in his introduction to Pirkei Avot, people interpret a brave person, they say a brave person is one who takes unnecessary risks. That's not true. That's a stupid person. A brave person is one that when he has to, he's going to stand up to the test. He's going to stand up to the risks, to the dangers. But he doesn't do them unnecessarily. The Torah tells us we have to love Hashem. How do you love Hashem? How do you love Hashem? So Rambam says, Heichi haderech, what's the path to loving Hashem? We have to know that love is a path. Loving your wife is a path. It doesn't happen overnight. You can love her on a certain level when you get married. You want to reach true love, it's a path. It's a journey. It takes a lot of time. It doesn't happen in a year. It doesn't happen in a decade. It happens over time. You can appreciate. You can have certain levels of love. It grows. Loving Hashem is also a path. Says the Rambam, how do you love Hashem? What's the path? Says the Rambam. Look at nature. Look at the things Hashem created. Have awe. Now that means you have to look at nature. Yes, you have to sometimes stop and say, what a beautiful sunset. What a beautiful sunrise. What a beautiful building. What beautiful stars. As we start looking at the world Hashem created, we can love Hashem through the Torah. We see the beauty of the Torah. Through that, we grow in our connection. It says, "Ulidavkabo," to connect to Hashem. How do you connect to Hashem? Hashem's fire. How do you connect to Hashem? So our sages say, connect to the teachers of Torah. When a person connects, that's how a person grows. I'm going to tell you a secret. You could try it on everyone else. Please don't try it on me. Okay? When I went to yeshiva, so my big brother told me the following tip. He said, you come to yeshiva, everyone's scared of the rabbis, everyone's scared of the Rosh Yeshiva. You walk over to them and say, Rabbi, can I learn with you one-on-one? And you'll be surprised, sometimes they'll say yes. And if they say no, so you'll say, okay, can we do it once a week? Sometimes they'll say yes. And if they say no, so then you'll say, can we do it once a month? And you'll see, you'll learn with them. And thanks to that beautiful piece of advice, I got to learn with the Posek of Meir, with Dayan of Williamsburg, with Rav Ozband, with the giants of Torah. I got to learn them one-on-one because I went and I asked. I got to learn with Rav Pesen Zatzal one-on-one. I can give you a list for the next few minutes of the different rabbis throughout my life that I learned with either one-on-one or almost one-on-one. The funny story, I called Rav Shlomo Fisher once, and I asked if I could come to his class. He said, sure, so I sat in the class, and I'm sitting in the class, every so often I ask a question, okay, this goes on for a year or two, I don't remember how long it went on, and I would even argue with the people around me in the class. Okay, a few years pass, and I start seeing the faces from the shiur I see them in different places, and suddenly I realize Mr. So-and-so, he's not a Mr., he's Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva A. And then I meet Mr. the next guy, and he's Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva B. Turns out the class I was attending was a class for Rosh Yeshiva. Shalom Fisher was giving class, and I was first year base medrash, I was all of 18, but I called the rabbi himself and I said, I want to come learn your Torah, I hear you give a class on Fridays, can I come? He said, sure, come. So I come in and I'm sitting, the whole table is Rosh Yeshiva, everyone but me. I'm this pipsqueak sitting at the same table as them, but I learned 2 years there, I didn't know it. I'm listening to top shir, I didn't know it. Why? Because I went to the top and I said, can I? Torah says, connect him. I bought a car in the Lower East Side just so that I can drive Rav Feinstein around. Whenever I could, he had a different driver, but whenever he couldn't, I would take him. I bought a car just for that. Okay, in America, a car is cheaper, I'm saying that. But that was the reason I had a car. I wasn't driving anywhere. I'd park it until I could drive it. This way you get close to someone, you learn from them. We're moving on to Parshat Vayelech. Vayelech. Moshe is up to the final day of his life. Moshe Rabbeinu knows he's going to die today. This is unique to Moshe Rabbeinu. Our tradition is that man cannot know. David HaMelech writes in Tehillim that he said to Hashem, Hodi'eini Hashem Kitzi. Tell me, Hashem, how long am I going to live? Umidat Yamai Mahi. Tell me how much measurement, how much life you've given me. Eidea mechadel ani. I want to know when I will cease to live in this world. David HaMelech asked Hashem, and Hashem says, no, I created a world where I don't tell people when they're going to die. So David asks, Hashem, can you at least tell me the day of the week? So Hashem says, okay, it's a Shabbos. So what does David answer? It's a funny answer in the Gemara. He says, can we make it Sunday? So Rashi right away says, that he said, I'm gonna lie there as a corpse all of Shabbos. No one will be able to do anything with me. Let me have a normal death and burial, which really happened. Meaning when David died, his corpse was left lying in the sun. And that David lamented that when he realized that would happen. He said, a live dog is better than the dead lion. He was talking about himself, the dead lion. He said, I'm gonna be lying in the sun. So David asks, okay, can we make it Friday? So Hashem says, no. So Moshe Rabbeinu knows this is his last day. On the one hand, Moshe Rabbeinu gets to know that. Hashem tells him, today you're going to die. And Be'ezrat Hashem, on Thursday night, we're going to learn the fantastic medrash that spans pages of the conversation between Moshe and Hashem, where Hashem tells him, you're going to die. And Moshe says, I don't want to. And Hashem says, it's time to go. And Moshe says, wait. And the argument, back and forth, where Moshe argues why he shouldn't die. There we have pages and pages of Medrash of this argument that goes back and forth between Hashem and Moshe, where Hashem tells him he's got to go, and Moshe has good arguments why he shouldn't die. Our sages say, En shilton b'yom ha-mavit. The day of death comes, everyone resigns. There comes a point where there's no more ruler. You're not the big boss anymore. Until this day, when Moshe wanted to talk to the people, he was king, he blew trumpets, everyone gathered. It's his last day, he's no more king. He has to go to the people. Now there's no more trumpets. Moshe Rabbeinu is demoted. And that's a medrash. The medrash says that when Moshe begged to come into Eretz Yisrael, so Hashem said, your student Yeshua has to be the leader. You can't stay the leader. It's time for Yeshua, new leadership. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, I'm willing to be his student. So Hashem said, okay, if you're willing to be a student, fine. So Moshe Rabbeinu, the next morning, Yeshua is the leader. Moshe Rabbeinu comes and stands by Yeshua's door. So Yeshua comes out of the door and he sees Moshe standing there. He says, Rebbe, what are you doing here? So Moshe says, God said, you're supposed to be the leader now. And just like when I was the leader, you stood by my door to wait for me in the morning. I'm standing by your door to wait for you. So Yeshua starts trembling and he goes to the Ohel Moed. And then Hashem tells him something, and when he comes out, so Moshe standing in attendance waiting, and Moshe asks him, what did Hashem say? And Yeshua says, when you were the Rebbe, were you telling me everything Hashem said? You know that some things Hashem tells me that I'm not supposed to tell anyone else. Not everything I'm told I'm supposed to tell other people. So the Medrash says that at that moment, Moshe Rabbeinu started crying. Moshe Rabbeinu said, Ribbono Shel Olam, let me die 1,000 deaths and not taste the taste of jealousy. He saw, I can't live in this world and be jealous of Yehoshua. I can't. To be here and see that Yehoshua is close to Hashem, and I can't be on that level of closeness, I don't want to live in the world. And he has to die. So that's the short Medrash. The long Medrash will visit Meretz Hashem Thursday night. So Moshe goes to the Jewish people and he tells them, that's it, my license is over. Today is my last day, and Hashem told me I'm not going into the land of Israel, but I need to tell you a final speech. So the first thing Moshe Rabbeinu tells them is, Hashem is going before you. Hashem is going before you. Let's take a step back for a second. Moshe Rabbeinu says, I am 120 years old today. Our sages say, what does it mean today? It means he was telling them, Hayom male'u yamai ushnotai. Today is my birthday. And from here our sages derived, et mispa yamecha amalei, that when Hashem says, I will fill your days, it means that tzaddikim pass away on the day they were born. And the Talmud assumes this for many tzaddikim, that the day they die is the day they were born. They live a whole life that is reflected in the days and years that they live. Now, can we do something advanced, or it's the end of the night, we should wait for a different night? You guys have koach? Can I challenge you a little bit? Yes? I don't hear you. Your yes is weak.
Yes, yes.
Yes? Oh, okay. How old was Moshe when he came to take the Jews out of Egypt? How long were the plagues? 1 year. How old is Moshe when we leave Mitzrayim? 81 years old. How many years are we in the desert? 40. How old is Moshe supposed to be now? 121. Good question? Okay. Pasuk says, I'm 120 years old. Shouldn't he be 121? 80 plus 1, 81 plus 40, 121. It's easy math. Okay. Did I annoy you a little bit? Good. Then we'll revisit the question Thursday night. Stay tuned. Yes? Okay. We move on. Moshe tells them, Hashem is passing before you. Yehoshua is passing before you. Our tradition is that Moshe was telling them, when Yehoshua passes before you, you'll succeed. And if not, you won't succeed. Our sages say that when Moshe was going to pass from the world, so then in the end of the Torah it says that Moshe went up from Arvos Moav to Mount Nebo. So our tradition is that there were 12 large stones from Arvos Moav to Mount Nebo. And Moshe took one leap and just jumped past all 12 stones. So our sages say, till Moshe's last minute, he was as powerful as a youngster. Moshe's eyes didn't go bad, his skin didn't dry up. As people age, their skin shrivels. Not Moshe. Moshe was powerful till the last day. When he says, I can't lead you anymore, he's saying, Hashem told me I can't. It's over, Yehoshua's the next leader. And look around, Moshe's telling them. We've conquered a large territory here on the eastern side of the Jordan. Well, just as you've conquered them, Hashem is going to let you conquer everyone else. Don't be scared, because Hashem is with you. So, if a person's confident because they have F-16s, so then maybe the enemy has a more sophisticated weapon. If a person's confident because his soldiers got good training, well, maybe the enemy's got better training. If a person's confident because they have an atomic bomb, well, maybe the enemy has a hydrogen bomb. If a person's confident because of all kinds of external strength, you never know if you'll win. Moshe's telling them, you have nothing to fear because Hashem is going with you. It's not about your weapons. It's not about your training. Moshe calls Yehoshua. And in front of all of Israel, he tells him, be strong, you're the leader. And here, this is probably best understood, going with Rav Charlap. Rav Charlap had explained that when Moshe sent the spies into Israel, when he blessed Yehoshua, he was appointing Yehoshua as the leader. And in that, it seems that Yehoshua did not succeed, because they usurped him. Moshe was warning him, lead them, make sure they don't mess up. That's why he gave Yeshua the extra letter in the name. Yehoshua, he will save you. They were all supposed to follow Yeshua's lead. And even though Yeshua himself wasn't destroyed, he retained his piety, but they did succeed in usurping him. At the end of the day, the spies did succeed in getting the whole people to sin. So that's why Moshe keeps telling Yeshua, be strong, be strong. You're the leader, that's it. No one should rebel against you. And then Moshe writes the Torah. Moshe writes the Torah. And he gives a copy of the Torah to his tribe. Our sages say that that Torah remained in the Beit HaMikdash. There was a Torah that people could always check. If there's a mistake in their Sefer Torah, they could come to the Beit HaMikdash and compare their Torah to Moshe's Torah. Moshe wrote one final copy of the Torah. And here there's a discussion in Talmud. What about the final 8 verses of Torah that describe Moshe's death? Who wrote that? So one opinion in Talmud is that Moshe wrote it bedema. Moshe wrote it in some kind of haze. He wrote about his own passing. Hashem had him write it, and there was a haze. There's a beautiful pshat, I don't know who says it, that says that bedema means tearing. That Moshe was tearing, he was crying as he was writing the psukim describing his own death. And the Medrash says that when Moshe came to write those psukim, so Hashem said, dip your quill in your tears and write it. Moshe kotev bedema, the ink on his quill were his own tears as he wrote those 8 psukim. So, yes.
But Moshe wrote it on Mount Sinai, no?
No. So, the Gemara says that the final version of Torah was now, at the end of Moshe's life. At Sinai, they got the Torah till Parshat Mishpatim, and then each time Moshe would teach them another parsha. It kept getting written, not exactly as a diary, but it kept getting written until finally here, Moshe gave them a final version. Now is the closing of the Torah. So Moshe gives us our last mitzvah. Moshe tells us the mitzvah of Hakel. After 7 years, after Shemitah, when Shemitah is over, we come to the Beit HaMikdash on Sukkot, and the king reads the Torah to the people. The masses gather, and the king reads the Torah. So we have a special mitzvah to come and bring our children, and our children, everyone will hear the Torah from the king. And Hashem tells Moshe, I want you to come and take Yeshua to the Ohel Moed. Everyone will see how you're appointing him the next leader. And Hashem appears and tells Moshe, when you pass on, the nation will transgress. When the nation transgresses, I will hide myself from them, and all kinds of bad things will befall them. And then they're going to say, Hashem isn't with me, that's why all these things are happening. Hashem tells Moshe, I want you to write a song. And this song will tell them all of Jewish history. And when things befall them, they'll always be able to look back to that song and say, God warned us, God already told us this would happen. And that song is the story of Ha'azinu. That's Parshat Ha'azinu. So I always like telling the story when I was an MTJ. There was a guy named Aaron who would show up. Aaron had a sister in Florida who took good care of him. And she put him on pills, and that made him normal. And he'd run away from his sister in Florida and come back to MTJ. And when he'd walk in, he'd be looking very refined and dignified, and he'd sit and learn. And then as his pills wore off, you'd see him going downhill. And his sister couldn't always run after him, come back across the states and pick him up and take him back down. And you'd see him deteriorating to the point where after a few months, he'd be walking around with a cart collecting charity, and he'd come back to yeshiva at night and he'd make in his pants, and it wasn't so pleasant to be around him. And he was completely, completely lost, meaning if any semblance of maturity and responsibility that had been there when he walked in was gone after a few months. As the pills wore off, he deteriorated completely. And he'd walk around like a homeless beggar. He'd come back to yeshiva to go to sleep, and you couldn't have a coherent conversation with him. And he'd sit down on his mattress, and before he'd go to sleep, he'd start singing. Hazinu ha-shamayim v'adam be'irav v'tishma ha-aretz imrifi Ya'rov kamata likhi tizal katal imratihi. And he's singing all of Hazinu by heart before he goes to sleep. Someone taught him as a kid the song of Hazinu. Moshe Rabbeinu tells us at the end of the parasha, all Jews should know this song, because this song is the testimony of the Jewish people. I'm telling them now, it's almost 1,000 years before the golden era of the Jewish people will end. We're still going to have 1,000 years of wonderful times, entering Israel, conquering Israel, expanding, having an economy, having a government, having growth, expansion, everything's going to be great. And then the destruction will hit almost a millennium later. And the Torah records now, here's the song of what's going to befall the Jewish people. So that when it happens, they shouldn't say, oh, God isn't with us anymore. No. When things were good, Hashem said, here's what's going to happen, and I'm telling it to you now. Write it down and teach the kids. Make sure people know the song. So that they know that when it happens, it's not because I've left them. It's because of what they've done. They're being punished until they do tshuva. That's the song of Azinu, only it's a little bit more detailed. Our sages say that when the Torah commands us, write down this song, write down this song as a commandment to write the Torah. The commandment for every Jew to write a Sefer Torah is expressed in the words, Kitvu lachem et hashira hazot. Write down this song. The Torah is called the song. We're supposed to learn Torah in a sing song. We're supposed to see the beauty of the Torah. The Torah is the song that we're commanded to write down. Today we fulfill that mitzvah by purchasing Sfarim that we learn from. The idea of writing the Torah is to write a Torah that you learn from. We don't learn from the Torah scroll in the ark. We learn from the books that we buy. So as we expand our libraries, which is something every person should do, we're fulfilling this mitzvah of writing down the song of the Torah. See you guys, Bezalel Shem Thursday.